Chapter 5. The comet had no name. It might once have been classified and catalogued, but not in living memory, and certainly no information relating to it was to be found in any public database. No transponder had ever been anchored to its surface, no skyjacks had ever grappled themselves in and extracted a core sample. To all intents and purposes it was completely unremarkable, simply one member of a much larger swarm of cold drifters. There were billions of them, each following a slowly and stately orbit around Epsilon Eridani. For the most part, they had been undisturbed since the system's formation. Very occasionally, a resonant perturbation of the system's larger worlds might unshackle a few members of the swarm and send them falling in on sun-grazing orbits, but for the vast majority of comets, the future would consist only of more orbits around Eridani, until the sun itself swelled up. Until then they would remain dormant, insufferably cold and still. The comet was large, as swarm members went, but not unusually so. There were at least a million that were larger. From edge to edge it was a 20-kilometer frozen mudball of nearly black ice. A lightly compacted meringue of methane, carbon monoxide, nitrogen and oxygen, laced with silicates, sooty hydrocarbons, and a few glistening veins of purple or emerald organic macromolecules. They had crystallized into beautiful refractive crystal seams several billion years earlier, when the galaxy was a younger and quieter place. Mostly, though, it was pitifully dark. Epsilon Eridani was merely a hard glint of light at this distance, 13 light hours away. It looked scarcely less remote than the brighter stars. But humans had come, once. They had arrived in a squadron of dark spacecraft, their holds bursting with transforming machines. They had covered the comet in a coil of transparent plastic, enveloping it like a froth of digestive spit. The plastic had given the comet structural rigidity it would otherwise have lacked, but from a distance it was all but undetectable. The backscatter from radar or spectroscopic scans was only slightly compromised, and remained well within the anticipated error of Demarchist measurements. With the comet held stiff by its plastic shell, the humans had set about sapping its spin. Ion rockets, emplaced cunningly across its face, slowly bled it of angular momentum. Only when there was a small residual spin, enough to ward off suspicion, were the ion rockets quietened and the installations removed from the surface. But by then the humans had already been busy inside. They had cored out the comet, tamping 80% of its interior volume into a thin, hard shell that was used to line the outer shell. The resultant chamber was 15 kilometers wide and perfectly spherical. Concealed shafts permitted entry into the chamber from outside space, wide enough to accept a moderately large spacecraft, provided the ship moved nimbly. Berthing and repair yards festered across the inner surface of the chamber like the dense grid of a cityscape, interrupted here and there by the cryo-arithmetic engines, squat black domes which studded the grid like volcanic cinder plugs. The huge engines were quantum refrigerators, sucking heat out of the local universe by computational cooling. Clavain had made the entrance transition enough times not to be alarmed by the sudden whiplash course adjustments necessary to avoid collisions with the comet's rotating husk. At least that was what he told himself. But the truth was he never drew breath until he was safely inside or out. It was too much like diving through the narrowing gap in a lowering portcullis, and with a ship as large as Nightshade, the adjustments were even more brutal. He entrusted the operation to Nightshade's computers. They knew exactly what needed to be done, and the insertion was precisely the kind of well-specified problem that computers handled better than people, even conjoined people. Then it was over, and he was in. Not for the first time, Clavain felt a dizzying sense of vertigo as the comet's interior space came into view. The husk had not stayed hollow for long. Its cored-out volume was filled with moving machinery, a great nested clockwork of rushing circles, resembling nothing so much as a fantastically complex armillary sphere. He was looking at the military stronghold of his people, the Mother Nest. There were 5 layers to the Mother Nest. The outer 4 were all engineered to simulate gravity in half-G increments. Each layer consisted of three rings of nearly equal diameter, the plane of each ring tilted by 60 degrees from its neighbor. There were two nodes where the three rings passed close to each other, and at each of these nodes the rings vanished into a hexagonal structure. The nodal structures functioned both as an interchange between rings and a means of guiding them. Each ring slid through sleeves in the nodal structures, constrained by frictionless magnetic fields. The rings themselves were dark bands, studded with myriad tiny windows and the occasional larger illuminated space. The outermost triplet of rings was 10 kilometers across and simulated gravity at 2 g's. 1 kilometer of empty space inwards, a smaller triplet of rings spun within the outermost shell, simulating gravity at 1.5 g's. 1 kilometer in from that was the 1 g ring triplet, consisting of by far the thickest and most densely populated set of rings, where the majority of the conjoiners spent the bulk of their time. Nestling within that was the 1/2 g triplet, which in turn encased a transparent central sphere that did not rotate. That was the null g core, a pressurized bubble 3 kilometers wide, stuffed with greenery, sun lamps, and various microhabitat niches. It was where children played and elderly conjoiners came to die. It was also where Felka spent most of her time. Nightshade decelerated and came to a stop relative to the outermost triplet. Already, servicing craft were emerging from the whirling rings. Clavain felt the jolts as the tugs latched on to Nightshade's hull. When he had disembarked, his vessel would be hauled towards the shipyards, quilting the chamber's wall. There were many ships already berthed there, various elongated black shapes hooked into a labyrinth of support machines and repair systems. Most were smaller than Clavain's ship, however, and there were no genuinely large vessels. Clavain left the ship with his usual slight feeling of unease, of a job not properly finished. It had been many years before he realized quite what caused this. It was the way that his fellow conjoiners said nothing to each other as they left the craft, despite the fact that they might have spent months together on a mission and encountered many risks. A robot tender collected him from one of the hull airlocks. The tender was an upright box with generous windows, squatting on a rectangular base studded with rockets and impeller fans. Clavain boarded it, watching a large tender depart from the next airlock along. In the other tender he saw Remontoire with two other conjoiners and the prisoner they had captured on the Demarchist ship. From a distance, the pig, slouched and docile, could easily have been mistaken for a human prisoner. For a moment Clavain thought that the pig was being pleasingly cooperative, until he recognized the glint of a pacification coronet wrapped around the prisoner's scalp. They had trawled the pig on the way back to the mother nest, but had learned nothing specific. The pig's memories were highly blockaded. Not in the conjoiner fashion, but in the crude black market style that was common amongst the Chasm City criminal underworld, and which was usually implemented to shield incriminating memories from the various branches of the Ferrisville Constabulary, the Sirens, Scythes, Skulltappers, and Eraserheads. With the kind of interrogation techniques that were possible in the Mother Nest, Clavain had no doubt that the blockades could be dismantled. But until then he could discover nothing other than that they had recovered a small-time pig criminal with violent tendencies, probably affiliated to one of the larger pig gangs operating in and around Yellowstone and the Rust Belt. Clearly the pig had been up to no good when he was captured by the Demarchists, but that was hardly unusual for pigs. Clavain neither liked nor disliked hyper-pigs. He had met enough to know that they were as morally complex as the humans they had been engineered to serve, and that every pig should be judged on its own terms. A pig from Ganesh Industrial Moon had saved his life 3 times during the Shiva Parvati cordon crisis of 2358. 20 years later, on Iravel's moon, orbiting Fand, a group of pig brigands had taken 8 of Clavain's soldiers hostage and had then begun to eat them alive when they refused to divulge conjoiner secrets. Only one conjoiner had escaped, and Clavain had taken his pain-saturated memories as his own. He carried them now, locked away in the most secure kind of mental partition, so that they could not be unlocked accidentally. But even this had not made him hate pigs as a species. He was not sure whether the same could be said for Remontoir. Deep in Remontoir's past lay an even more horrific and protracted episode, when he had been taken prisoner by the pig pirate Run 7. Run 7 had been one of the earliest hyperpigs, and his mind had been riddled with the psychotic scars of flawed neurogenetic augmentation. He had captured Remontoir and isolated him from the mental communion of other conjoiners. That had been enough of a torture, but Run 7 had not stinted on the other, older kind, and he had been very good at it. Remontoir had escaped, finally, and the pig had died, but Clavain knew that his friend still carried profound mental wounds that now and then broke through to the surface. Clavain had watched very carefully when Remontoir made the preliminary trawls of the pig, fully aware of how easily that procedure could become a kind of torture in its own right. And while nothing that Remontoir had done had been improper, indeed he had been almost too reticent in his inquiries, Clavain admitted to feeling a sense of misgiving. If only it had not been a pig, he thought, and if only Remontoir had not had to be associated with the prisoner's questioning. Clavain watched the other tender fall away from Nightshade, convinced that he had not heard the last of the pig, and that the repercussions of the capture would be with them for some time. Then he smiled and told himself he was being silly. It was only a pig, after all. Clavain issued a neural command to the simple sub-persona of the tender, and with a lurch, they detached from the dark, whale-like hull of Nightshade. The tender whisked him inwards, through the great rushing clockwork of the centrifugal wheels, towards the green heart of the Null G core. This stronghold, this particular mother nest, was only the latest to be built. Though there had always been a mother nest of sorts, in the war's early stages, it had only been the largest of many camouflaged encampments. Two-thirds of the conjoined had been spread throughout the system in smaller bases, but separation brought its own problems. The individual groups had been light hours apart, and the lines of communication between them had been vulnerable to interception. Strategies could not be evolved in real time, nor could the group mind state be extended to encompass two or more nests. The conjoiners had become fragmented and nervous. Reluctantly, the decision had been taken to absorb the smaller nests into one vast mother nest, hoping that the advantage gained through centralization would outweigh the danger involved in placing all their eggs in one basket. With hindsight, the decision had been massively successful. The tender slowed as it neared the membrane of the Null G core. Clavain felt utterly dwarfed by the green sphere. It glowed with its own soft radiance, like a verdant miniature planet. The tender squelched through the membrane into air. Clavain dropped a window, allowing the core's atmosphere to mingle with the tender's own. His nose prickled at the vegetative assault. The air was cool and fresh and moist. It smelled that of a forest after an intense mid-morning thunderstorm. Though he had visited the core on countless occasions, the scent nonetheless made Clavain think not of those previous visits, but of his childhood. He could not say when or where, but he had certainly walked through a forest that had this quality. It had been somewhere on Earth. Scotland, perhaps. There was no gravity in the core, but the vegetation that filled it was not a free-floating mass. Threading the sphere from side to side were spars of oak up to 3 kilometers long. The spars branched and merged randomly, forming a wooden cytoskeleton of pleasing complexity. Here and there the spars bulged sufficiently to accommodate enclosed spaces, hollows that glowed with pastel lantern light. Elsewhere, a cobweb of smaller strands provided a structural mesh to which most of the greenery was anchored. The whole assemblage was festooned with irrigation pipes and nutrient feed lines, threading back into the support machinery lurking at the very heart of the core. Sun lamps studded the membrane at irregular intervals, and were distributed throughout the green masses themselves. Now they shone with the hard blue light of high noon, but as the day progressed, they were slave to 26-hour Yellowstone time. The lamps would slide down through the spectrum towards the bronze and russet reds of evening. Eventually night would fall. The spherical forest would come alive with the chirrups and calls of 1,000 weirdly evolved nocturnal animals. Squatting on a spar near its heart during nightfall, It would be easy to believe that the forest reached away in all directions for thousands of kilometers. The distant centrifugal wheels were only visible from the last 100 meters of greenery beneath the membrane, and they were, of course, utterly silent. The tender dodged through the mass, knowing precisely where it had to take Clavaine. Now and then he saw other conjoiners, but they were mostly children or the elderly. The children were born and raised in the 1G triplet, but when they were 6 months old, they were brought here at regular intervals. Supervised by the elderly, they learned the muscle and orientation skills necessary for weightlessness. For most of them it was a game, but the very best would be earmarked for duty in the arena of space war. A few, a very few, showed such heightened spatial skills that they would be steered towards battle planning. The elderly were too frail to spend much time in high-G rings. Once they had come to the core, they often never left. Clavaine passed a couple now. They both wore support rigs, medical harnesses that doubled as propulsion packs. Their legs trailed behind them like afterthoughts. They were coaxing a quintet of children into kicking off from one side of a woody hollow into open space. Seen without augmented vision, the scene had a tangibly sinister quality. The children were garbed in black suits and helmets that protected their skin against sharp branches. Their eyes were hidden behind black goggles, making it difficult to interpret their expressions. The elderly were equally drab, though they wore no helmets. But their fully visible faces betrayed nothing resembling enjoyment. To Clavaine, they looked like undertakers engaged in some solemn burial duty that would be ruined by the slightest hint of levity. Clavaine willed his implants to reveal the truth. There was a moment of florid growth as bright structures blossomed into existence out of thin air. The children wore filmy clothes now, marked with tribal swirls and zigzags of lurid color. Their heads were bare, unencumbered by helmets. Two were boys, three were girls. He judged their ages to lie between 5 and 7. Their expressions were not entirely joyous, but neither were they miserable or neutral. Instead, they all looked slightly scared and slightly exhilarated. No doubt there was some rivalry going on, each child weighing the benefits and risks of being the first to take the aerial plunge. The elderly couple still looked much the same, but now Clavaine was attuned to the thoughts they were radiating. Bathed in an aura of encouragement, their faces now looked serene and patient rather than dour. They were quite prepared to wait hours for the children. The environment itself had also changed. The air was full of jewel-bright butterflies and dragonflies, darting to and fro on busy trajectories. Neon caterpillars worked their way through the greenery. Hummingbirds hovered and translated from flower to flower, moving like precisely programmed clockwork toys. Monkeys, lemurs, and flying squirrels jumped into free space with abandon, their eyes gleaming like marbles. This was what the children perceived, and what Clavaine was tuned into. They had known no other world but this storybook abstraction. Subtly, as they aged, the data reaching their brains would be manipulated. They would never notice the change from day to day, but the creatures haunting the forest spaces would gradually grow more realistic, their colors dimming to naturalistic greens and browns, blacks and whites. The creatures would become smaller and more elusive. Eventually, only the real animals would remain. Then, the children would be 10 or 11 at this point. They would be gently educated about the machines that had doctored their view of the world so far. They would learn of their implants and how they enabled a second layer to be draped over reality, one that could be shaped into any form imaginable. For Clavaine, the educational process had been somewhat more brutal. It had been during his second visit to Galliana's nest on Mars. She had shown him the nursery where the young conjoiners were being instructed, but at that point, he had not possessed any implants of his own. Then he had been injured, and Galliana had filled his head with medicines. He still remembered the heart-stopping moment when he had first experienced his subjective reality being manipulated. The feeling of his own skull being gate-crashed by numerous other minds had only been part of it, but perhaps the most shocking element had been his first glimpse of the realm the conjoiners walked through. The psychologists had a term for it, cognitive breakthrough, but few of them could have experienced it for themselves. Suddenly, he drew the attention of the children.
Clavain!
One of the boys had pushed a thought into his head. Clavain made the tender come to a halt in the middle of the space the children were using for flying lessons. He orientated the tender so that he was more or less level with them.
Hello.
Clavain gripped the handrail in front of him like a preacher at a pulpit. A girl looked at him intently.
Where have you been, Clavain?
Outside. He eyed the tutors carefully.
Outside?
Beyond the mother nest, the girl persisted. He was unsure how to answer. He did not remember how much knowledge the children possessed at this age. Certainly they knew nothing of the war, but it was difficult to discuss one thing without it leading to another.
Beyond the mother nest?
Yes.
In a spaceship?
Yes. In a very big spaceship.
Can I see it?
The girl asked. One day, I expect. Not today, though. He felt the tutor's disquiet, though neither had placed a concrete thought in his head. You've got other things to take care of, I think.
What did you do in the spaceship, Clavain?
Clavain scratched his beard. He did not enjoy misleading children and had never quite got the hang of white lies. A mild distillation of the truth seemed the best approach. I helped someone.
Whom did you help?
A lady. A woman.
Why did she need your help?
Her ship, her spaceship, had got into trouble. She needed some assistance and I just happened to be passing by.
What was the lady called?
Banks. Antoinette Banks. I gave her a nudge with a rocket to stop her falling back into a gas giant.
Why was she coming out of the gas giant?
I don't really know, to tell the truth.
Why did she have two names, Clavain?
Because... This was going to get very messy, he realized. Look, I shouldn't interrupt you. I really shouldn't. He felt a palpable relaxation in the tutor's emotional aura. So, who's going to show me what a good flyer they are, then? It was all the spur that the children needed. A welter of voices crowded his skull, competing for his attention.
Me, Clavain, me!
He watched them kick off into the void, barely able to contain themselves. There was a moment when he was still peering into green infinity, and then the tender burst through a shimmer of leaves into a clearing. It had navigated the forest for another 3 or 4 minutes after leaving the children, knowing exactly where to find Felka. The clearing was a spherical space enclosed on all sides by dense growth. One of the structural spars thrust its way clean through the volume, bulging with residential spaces. The tender whirred closer to the spar and then held station with its impellers, while Clavain disembarked. Ladders and vines provided hand and footholds, allowing him to work his way along the spar until he found the entrance to its hollow interior. There was some sense of vertigo, but it was slight. Part of his mind would probably always quail at the thought of clambering recklessly through what felt like a forest's elevated canopy. But the years had diminished that nagging primate anxiety to the point where it was barely noticeable. Felka! He called ahead. It's Clavain! There was no immediate answer. He burrowed deeper, descending, or ascending, head first. Felka! Hello, Clavain! Her voice boomed from the middle distance, echoed and amplified by the spar's peculiar acoustics. He followed the voice. He could not feel her thoughts. Felka did not participate routinely in the conjoined mind state, although that had not always been the case. But even if she had, Clavain would have maintained a certain distance. Long ago, by mutual consent, they had elected to exclude themselves from each other's minds, except at the most trivial level. Anything else would have been an unwanted intimacy. The shaft ended in a womb-like interior space. This was where Felka spent most of her time these days, in her laboratory and atelier. The walls were a beguiling swirl of wooden growth patterns. To Clavain's eye, the ellipses and knots resembled geodesic contours of highly stressed space-time. Lanterns glowed in sconces, throwing his shadow across the wood in threatening ogre-like shapes. He helped himself along by his fingertips, brushing past ornate wooden contraptions that floated untethered through the spar. Clavain recognized most of the objects well enough, but one or two looked new to him. He snatched one from the air for closer examination.
It rattled in his grasp. It was a human head fashioned from a single helix of wood. Through the gaps in the spiral he could see another head inside, and another inside that one. Possibly there were more. He let the object go and seized another. This one was a sphere bristling with sticks, projecting out to various distances from the surface. Clavain adjusted one of the sticks and felt something click and move within the sphere, like the tumbler of a lock. "I see you've been busy, Falker," he said.
"I gather I wasn't the only one," she replied.
"I heard reports. Some business about a prisoner." Clavain poured past another barrage of wooden objects and rounded a corner in the spa. He squeezed through a connecting aperture into a small windowless chamber lit only by lanterns. Their light threw pinks and emeralds across the ochre and tan shades of the walls. One wall consisted entirely of numerous wooden faces, carved with mildly exaggerated features. Those on the periphery were barely half-formed, like acid-etched gargoyles. The air was pungent with the resin of worked woods.
"I don't think the prisoner will amount to much," Clavain said. "His identity isn't apparent yet, but he seems to be some kind of pig criminal. We trawled him, retrieved clear and recent memory patterns that show him murdering people. I'll spare you the details, but he's creative, I'll give him that. It's not true what they say about pigs having no imagination."
"I never thought it was, Clavain. What about the other matter? The woman I hear you saved."
"Ah, funny how word gets around."
Then he recalled that it had been he who had told the children about Antoinette Bax.
"Was she surprised?" "I don't know. Should she have been?"
Falker snorted. She floated in the middle of the chamber, a bloated planet attended by many delicate wooden moons. She wore baggy brown work clothes. At least a dozen partially worked objects were guided to her waist by nylon filaments. Other lines were hooked into woodworking tools, which ranged from brooches and files to lasers and tiny tethered burrowing robots.
"I imagine she expected to die," Clavain said, "or at the very least to be assimilated."
"You seem upset by the fact that we're hated and feared."
"It does give one pause for thought."
Falker sighed, as if she had been over this a dozen times already.
"How long have we known each other, Clavain?"
"Longer than most people, I suppose."
"Yes, and for most of that time you were a soldier. Not always fighting, I'll grant you that. But you were always a soldier at heart."
Still with one eye on him, she hauled in one of her creations and peered through its latticed wooden interstices.
"It strikes me that it might be a little late in the day for moral qualms. Don't you agree?"
"You're probably right."
Falker bit her lower lip, and using a thicker line, propelled herself towards one wall of the chamber. Her entourage of wooden creations and tools clattered against each other as she moved. She set about making tea for Clavain.
"You didn't need to touch my face when I came in," Clavain remarked. "Should I take that as a good sign?"
"In what way?"
"It occurred to me that you might be getting better at discriminating faces."
"I'm not. Didn't you notice the wall of faces on your way in?"
"You must have done that recently," Clavain said.
"When someone comes in here that I'm not sure about, I touch their face, mapping its contours with my fingers. Then I compare what I've mapped with the faces I've carved in the wall until I find a match. Then I read off the name. Of course, I have to add new faces now and then, and some need less detail than others."
"But me?"
"You have a beard, Clavain, and a great many lines. You have thin white hair. I could hardly fail to recognize you, could I?"
"You're not like any of the others."
She passed him his bulb. He squeezed a stream of scalding tea into his throat.
"I don't suppose there's much point denying it."
He looked at her with as much detachment as he could muster, comparing the way she was now with his memory of her before he had left on Nightshade. It was only a matter of weeks, but in his estimation Falker had become more withdrawn, less a part of the world than at any time in recent memory. She spoke of visitors, but he had the strong suspicion that there had not been very many.
"Clavain?"
"Promise me something, Falker."
He waited until she had turned to look at him. Her black hair, which she wore as long as Galliana had, was matted and greasy. Nodes of sleep dust nestled in the corners of her eyes. Her eyes were pale green, almost jade, the irises jarring against bloodshot, pale pink. The skin beneath them was swollen and faintly blue, as if bruised. Like Clavain, Felka had a need for sleep that marked her as unusual amongst the conjoined.
Promise you what, Clavain?
If, when, it gets too bad, you'll let me know, won't you?
What good would it do?
You know I'd always try to do my best for you, don't you? Especially now that Galliana isn't here for us.
Her raw-rubbed eyes studied him.
You always did your best, Clavain. But you can't help what I am. You can't work miracles.
He nodded sadly. It was true, but knowing it hardly helped.
Felka was not like the other conjoiners. He had met her for the first time during his second trip to Galliana's nest on Mars. The product of an aborted experiment in fetal brain manipulation, she had been a tiny, damaged child, not merely unable to recognize faces, but unable to interact with other people at all. Her entire world revolved around a single, endlessly absorbing game. Galliana's nest had been encircled by a giant structure known as the Great Wall of Mars. The wall was a failed terraforming project that had been damaged in an earlier war. Yet it had never collapsed, for Felka's game involved coaxing the wall's self-repair mechanisms into activity, an endless, intricate process of identifying flaws and allocating precious repair resources. The 200-kilometer-high wall was at least as complex as a human body, and it was as if Felka controlled every single aspect of its healing mechanisms, from the tiniest cell upwards. Felka turned out to be much better at holding the wall together than a mere machine. Though her mind was damaged to the point where she could not relate to people at all, she had an astonishing ability for complex tasks. When the wall had collapsed in the final assault by Clavain's old comrades, the Coalition for Neural Purity, Galliana, Felka, and he had made a last-ditch escape from the nest. Galliana had tried to dissuade him from taking Felka, warning him that without the wall, she would experience a state of deprivation far crueler than death itself. But Clavain had taken her anyway, convinced that there had to be some hope for the girl, that there had to be something else her mind could latch onto as a surrogate for the wall. He had been right, but it had taken many years to prove the point. Through the years that followed, 400 of them, although neither of them had experienced more than a century of subjective time, Felka had been coaxed and guided towards her current, fragile state of mind. Subtle and delicate neural manipulation gave her back some of the brain functions that had been destroyed in the fetal intervention. Language and a growing sense that other people were more than mere automata. There were setbacks and failures. She had never learned to distinguish faces, for instance, but the triumphs outweighed them. Felka found other things to snare her mind, and during the long interstellar expedition she was happier than she had ever been. Every new world offered the prospect of a shatteringly difficult puzzle. Eventually, however, she had decided to return home. There had been no rancor between her and Galliana, merely a sense that it was time to begin collating the knowledge that she had helped gather so far, and that the best place to do so was the Mother Nest, with its vast analytic resources. But she returned to find the Mother Nest embroiled in war. Clavain was soon off fighting the Demarchists, and Felka found that interpreting the data from the expedition was no longer viewed as a high-priority task. Slowly, so slowly that it was barely evident from year to year, Clavain had watched her retreat back into her own private world. She had begun to play a less and less active role in Mother Nest affairs, isolating her mind from the other conjoiners except on rare occasions. Things had only worsened when Galliana had come back, neither dead nor alive, but in some horrible intermediate state. The wooden toys Felka surrounded herself with were symptoms of a desperate need to engage her mind with a problem worthy of her cognitive abilities. But, for all that they held her interest, they were doomed to fail in the long run. Clavain had seen it happen already. He knew that what Felka needed was beyond his powers to give.
"Perhaps when the war's over," he said lamely, "if Starflight becomes routine once more, and we start exploring again."
"Don't make promises you can't fulfill, Clavain."
Felka took her own drinking bulb and cast off into the midst of her chamber. Absently, she began to chisel away at one of her solid compositions. The thing she was working on looked like a cube made from smaller cubes, with square gaps in some of the faces. She poked the chisel into one of these gaps and rasped back and forth, barely looking at the thing. "I'm not promising anything," he said. "I'm just saying I'll do what I can."
"The jugglers might not even be able to help me."
"Well, we won't know until we try, will we?"
"I suppose not."
"That's the spirit," Clavaine said.
Something clunked inside the object she was working on. Felke hissed like a scalded cat and flung the ruined contraption at the nearest wall. It shattered into 100 blocky pieces. Almost without hesitation, she hauled in another piece and began working on that instead.
"And if the pattern jugglers don't help, we could try the shrouders."
Clavaine smiled. "Let's not get ahead of ourselves. If the jugglers don't work, then we can think about other possibilities, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. There's the small matter of winning a war first."
"But they say it will soon be over."
"They do, don't they?"
Felke slipped with the tool she was using and gouged a little flap of skin from the side of her finger. She pressed the finger against her mouth and sucked on it hard, like someone working the last drop of juice from a lemon.
"What makes you think otherwise?"
He felt an absurd urge to lower his voice, even though it made no practical difference.
"I don't know. Perhaps I'm just being a silly old fool. But what are silly old fools for, if not to have the occasional doubts now and then?"
Felke smiled tolerantly.
"Stop speaking in riddles, Clavaine."
"It's Skade and the closed council. Something's going on and I don't know what it is."
"Such as?"
Clavaine chose his words carefully. As much as he trusted Felke, he knew that he was dealing with a member of the closed council. The fact that she had not participated in the council for some time and was presumably out of the loop on its latest secrets did not count for much. "We stopped building ships a century ago. No one ever told me why, and I quickly realized it wasn't much use asking. In the meantime, I heard the odd rumor of mysterious goings-on, secret initiatives, secret technology acquisition programs, secret experiments. Then suddenly, just when the Demarchists are about to cave in and admit defeat, the closed council unveils a brand new starship design. Nightshade is nothing if it isn't a weapon, Felke. But who the hell are they planning to use it against if it isn't the Demarchists?"
"They, Clavaine?"
"I mean us."
Felke nodded. "But you occasionally wonder if the closed council isn't planning something behind the scene." Clavaine sipped at his tea.
"I'm entitled to wonder, aren't I?"
Felke was quiet for several long moments, the silence interrupted only by the rasp of her file against wood.
"I could answer some of your questions here and now, Clavaine. You know that.
You also know that I won't ever reveal what I learned in the closed council, just as you wouldn't if you were in my position."
He shrugged.
"I wouldn't expect anything less.
But even if I wanted to tell you, I don't think I know everything, not anymore. There are layers within layers. I was never privy to inner sanctum secrets, and I haven't been allowed near closed council data for years."
Felke tapped the file against her temple. "Some of the closed council members even want me to have my memories permanently scrubbed, so that I'll forget what I learned during my active council years. The only thing that's stopping them is my odd brain anatomy. They can't swear they wouldn't scrub the wrong memories."
"Every cloud has a silver lining."
She nodded. "But there is a solution, Clavaine. A pretty simple one when you think about it."
"Which is?"
"You could always join the closed council."
Clavaine sighed, grasping for an objection and knowing that even if he found one, it would be unlikely to satisfy Felke.
"I'll have some more of that tea, if you don't mind."
Skade strode through the curving grey corridors of the Mother Nest, her crest flaming with the scarlet of intense concentration and anger. She was on her way to the Privy Chamber, where she had arranged to meet Remontoire and a quorum of corporeal closed council members. Her mind was running near its maximum processing rate. She was contemplating how she would handle what was sure to be a delicate meeting, perhaps the most crucial in her campaign to recruit Clavaine to her side. Most of the closed council were putty in her hands, but there were a few that worried her, a few that would need more than the usual amount of convincing. Skade was also reviewing the digested final performance data from the secret systems inside Nightshade,
which were feeding into her skull via the compad, now resting across her abdomen like a piece of armor. The numbers were encouraging. There was nothing, other than the problem of keeping the breakthrough secret, to prevent a more extensive test of the machinery. She had already informed the Master of Works of the good news, so that the final technical refinements would be incorporated into the Exodus fleet. Although she had assigned a large fraction of herself to these issues, Skade was also replaying and processing a recording, a transmission that had recently arrived from the Ferrisville Convention. It was not good. The spokesperson hovered ahead of Skade, his back to the direction of her travel, his feet sliding ineffectually above the flooring. Skade was replaying the transmission at 10 times normal speed, lending the man's gestures a manic quality. "This is a formal request to any representative of the conjoined faction," said the convention spokesman. "It is known to the Ferrisville Convention that a conjoiner vessel was involved in the interception and boarding of a Demarchist ship in the neighborhood of the contested volume around gas giant." Skade fast-forwarded. She had already played the message 18 times, searching for nuance or deception. She knew that what followed was a supremely tedious list of legal strictures and convention statutes, all of which she had checked and found to be watertight. "Unknown to the conjoined faction, Maruska Chung, the shipmaster of the Demarchist vessel, had already made formal contact with officers of the Ferrisville Convention regarding the transfer into our custody of a prisoner. The prisoner in question had been detained aboard the Demarchist vessel after his arrest on a military asteroid under Demarchist jurisdiction, in accordance with..." More boilerplate. Fast forward again. "Prisoner in question, a hyperpig known to Ferrisville Convention as Scorpio, is already sought for the following crimes in contravention of emergency powers, General Statute number..." She allowed the message to cycle over again, but detected nothing that had not already been clear. The bureaucratic gnome of the convention seemed too obsessed with the minutiae of treaties and subclauses to be capable of real deception. He was almost certainly telling the truth about the pig. Scorpio was a criminal known to the authorities, a vicious murderer with a predilection for killing humans. Chung had told the convention that she was bringing him back into their care, presumably tight-beaming ahead before Nightshade had been close enough to snoop on her transmissions. And Clavain, damn him again, had not done what he should have done, which was wipe the Demarchists out of existence the first chance he got. The convention would have grumbled at that, but he would have been entirely within his rights. He could not have been expected to know about the shipmaster's prisoner of war, and he was not obliged to ask questions before opening fire. Instead, he had rescued the pig. "Request the immediate return of the prisoner into our custody, unharmed and uncontaminated by conjoiner neural infiltration systems, within 26 standard days. Failure to comply with this request?" The convention spokesman paused, wringing his hands in miserly anticipation. "Failure to comply would be greatly to the detriment of relations between the conjoined faction and the convention, as I need hardly stress." Skade understood perfectly. It was not that the prisoner was of any tangible value to the convention, but as a coup, as a trophy, the prisoner's value was incalculable. Law and order were already in a state of extreme collapse in convention airspace, and the pigs were a powerful and not always lawful group in their own right. It had been bad enough when Skade had gone to Chasm City herself on covert council business and had almost ended up dead. Matters had certainly not improved since. The pig's recapture and execution would send a powerful signal to other miscreants, especially the more criminally inclined pig factions. Had Skade been in the spokesman's position, she would have made much the same demand. But that didn't make the pig any less of a problem. On the face of it, knowing what Skade knew, there was no need to comply. It would not be long now before the convention was of no consequence at all. The Master of Works had assured her that the Exodus fleet would be ready in 70 days, and she had no reason to doubt the accuracy of the Master's estimate. 70 days. In 80 or 90, it would be done. In barely 3 months, nothing else would matter. But there was the problem. The fleet's existence and the reason for its existence had to remain a matter of total secrecy.
The impression had to be given that the conjoiners were pressing ahead towards the military victory that every neutral observer expected. Anything else would invite suspicion both from within and without the Mother Nest. And if the Demarchists discovered the truth, there was a chance, a slim one, but not something she could dismiss, that they might rally, using the information to gain allies that had previously remained neutral. Right now they were a spent force, but if they combined with the Ultras, they might present a real obstacle to Skade's ultimate objective. No. The charade of coming victory demanded a degree of obeisance to the convention. Skade would have to find a way of returning the pig, and it would have to happen before suspicion was roused. Her fury reached a crescendo. She made the spokesman freeze ahead of her. His body blackened into a silhouette. She strode through him, scattering him like a flock of startled ravens.